Everybody, I'm Beauty Cone Red House, and welcome, welcome, welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beauty Show. And of course, the reality is, and for those of you who've been listening to the show now for many years, you know that the reality is that we all go through so many ups and downs in our lives. Particularly, look at what's been going on in the last year. And when I was preparing for today's show, I think the number one issue and factor that has caused so many of us to be depressed and anxious is the feelings of disconnection and loneliness. And when I review the statistics, the depression statistics in this country, according to the American Medical Association, 30% of Americans are suffering, and I don't use that word lightly, from depression. 40 million adults are suffering from a variety of different anxiety disorders. And by the way, if we're talking about depression, depression is very different than sadness. And I just want to go through, and this is from the DSM-5, which is our psychiatric Bible, what depression is and isn't, and if it's been going on for weeks and months. I want you to think about whether or not, in fact, you really may be clinically depressed and not just going through a bad time. So if you're having depressed mood most of the day, nearly every day, regardless of what you are trying to do, or markedly diminished interest or pleasure in all or almost all activities, again, for most of the day, nearly every day. Or what about if you're finding that you're having significant weight loss when you're not dieting, or weight gain, or insomnia or hypersomnia nearly every day, or fatigue or loss of energy, again, nearly every day. And I have a patient who tells me virtually every day how fatigued and tired she'll get up and try and eat and maybe even go for a run. But after a couple of hours, she tells me that she just really wants to go to sleep. And she has had a very good physical health report and actually has been very, very resistant to inflating the idea of going on some antidepressant medication. Or what about if you're just feeling worthless, or you're walking around with excessive or inappropriate guilt? Or what about if you just cannot seem to be able to think or concentrate? And of course, at worst, recurrent thoughts of suicide. If you have suicide thoughts, or if you actually have even put together a plan. These are the things, and this is the time when it is really, really important for you to reach out and ask for help. Because I've been telling you for the last many, many years is that there are so many, so many life challenges, and that we need to give ourselves permission and tell ourselves that we do not need to navigate life's ups and downs and challenges, you know, on our own. And again, I want you to be really sure that if you're having some or all of these symptoms, that you really also need to think about having a complete physical. Perhaps you have a vitamin D deficiency or some thyroid issues, or low blood sugar or dehydration or some food intolerances. And the mind and body, there is a strong, strong connection, the mind-body connection. So again, if you're really feeling down in the dumps and you can't seem to find a way out, give yourself permission and see a psychotherapist and get an assessment. And who knows what you're going to find? Perhaps your depression is about a lot of unfinished business stemming from your childhood, your family of origin. Perhaps it is the abuse that you've never quite dealt with that has been triggered. And a lot of people have been telling me that their depression and anxiety was not necessarily caused by the pandemic, But certainly the pandemic has not helped a lot of people deal with current issues and deal with past trauma as well. And I was reading an article about depression and seniors. And for so often, seniors are really the forgotten generation. And did you know, for example, that at least 6.5 million Americans over the age of 65 are suffering from the symptoms of depression? And older Americans have an increased risk of depression when other illnesses limit their functioning. Of course, if they are not connected, if they do not have family and they do not have friends and they're living alone, these factors together can really, really cause an increased risk in depression. And remember that depression is not, just because we're getting older, depression is not a normal part of the aging process. And depression in older adults can increase, understandably, the risk for medical illness and cognitive decline. And older Americans typically, this is according to the studies, will likely seek out treatment for depression. And depression, according to studies, is the most significant risk factor for suicide attempts amongst the elderly. And there was a study done in 2004. And what the study found is that 14.3 of every 100,000 people aged 65 and older died by suicide. And in the general population, it was 11 of every 100,000 people that died by suicide. And you may be surprised to hear this statistic, that older white men, not women, have the highest rate of suicide in America. And if we're talking about suicide, the studies are also showing that younger people, the rates of suicide for younger people have quadrupled over the past 6 years. So hopefully what I do every week and what I've been doing for the last few years is to convince you is that when you're feeling lonely, when you're feeling down, when the depression and the anxiety has really taken over your life and you just simply don't know what to do, that the very best thing that you can do is reach out and ask for help. And of course, there are resources at churches and synagogues, and there are self-help groups, and of course, therapists and volunteering. You know, sometimes just getting ourselves out of our own head and our own space can make such a huge difference. And I know that when I was living in Sarasota, there were so many different retirement communities, and there were many women who I treated who were widows. And yet having people that they could see on the elevator walking around the retirement communities made people feel just so less alone and so much more connected. And I cannot stress the importance of finding ways that we can connect, whether it's to our gardens, whether or not it's to an animal, because taking care of others seems to have a great, great positive effect on ourselves as well. So again, that word is really connection. And of course, as I mentioned every single week, there are many things that we can do every single day. And of course, we have to be serious and we have to be mindful to make sure that we are eating well, the fruits, the vegetables, the grains, the fish, the nuts, the herbs, the supplements, and making sure again that we get sufficient sleep, and maybe even take some naps during the day if you're lucky to be able to do that. And again, the interaction and the socialization. And I know I go on and on and on about it because, for example, people in Sardinia, they happen to live the longest. And I was very curious. So what do they actually do? And studies have found that they eat healthily, they interact, they socialize, they sleep 8 hours a night, they take naps. And of course, the importance of exercise. Every single day, we need to get up. We need to take a walk around the block. None of this costs any money. We don't need to go to a gym. And of course, weight training is just so good. Again, not only is it good for our body and our toneness and our firmness, but it does wonderful, wonderful things for our mood as well. And I know so many people say, oh, I don't feel like exercising and I don't really care about weight training. And yet all of these behaviors, they all make such a difference, not only in our physical health, but our emotional health as well. And of course, the yoga and the meditation. And again, having really supportive people in our lives so that you're feeling down and you know that a phone call away or a Zoom call away, that you can reach out and that you will hopefully have someone in your life who you can talk to and who you can pour your heart out to and who is not going to judge you. And of course, Gary Noll talks about this all the time, about the importance of eliminating toxins, chemical toxins. And you know, when I talk about toxins, I typically am talking about toxic people and making sure that we eliminate poisonous people. And unfortunately, that sometimes means friends and family as well. So you have to really be very honest with yourself. And after you try to work out issues and problems with people who you might have really, really cared about, and you're finding that every time you're around them or every time you speak to them, that you feel bad, that you feel worse than you did before, then you have to really be able to have the strength and have the inner strength to make a decision and set boundaries so that you are not going to allow people to walk over certain lines and keep you in a state of sadness and upset. And we do. We have that kind of power and understanding, of course, that we can't change anybody at all. The best that we can do is encourage people to make changes. But what we can do, we can change ourselves. We can change our behaviors. We can change our interactions. We can change who we decide to connect with or not connect with. And if you find that it's difficult, you know that you need to make some changes, but you just don't feel that you have the strength or you have the capability of doing this on your own. Again, it doesn't mean if you reach out to a counselor or a therapist, that you're going to be in therapy and counseling for, you know, many, many years. But it is so important to be able to get a second opinion, another perspective on how to best go about navigating your lives and your relationships. You know, another thing that can really help, and I'm looking at some herbal tea that my husband Jim just brought me a couple of minutes ago, that is also something that for many, many people helps them to relax and calm them down, including aromatherapy and essential oils. And I also find, too, that journaling can be really, really important so that you're able to get a sense from one day to another, you know, what you're doing, what you're not doing, how you're feeling, and of course, most importantly, to figure out what you need to do to improve the quality of your life and your relationship. And of course, people, I mean, we're still dealing with the pandemic. So many people have lost their jobs. They're still concerned. They have health concerns. Many people have made the decision with the advice of Dr. Fauci and other scientists in the field to have the vaccines. But people are still concerned about the effects of the vaccine. Does it mean that I'm going to be able to go back to a more normal kind of life? So we're all in a process right now of trying to find our way. And I know that for myself, I really miss seeing my patients. My entire practice, and I can hardly even believe it, has been on Zoom since last March. I haven't seen anybody at all, only on the screen. And prior to the pandemic, I never would have encouraged people to spend all their time on social media, on Zooming and Skyping. This has been an absolutely great, great way that people can really connect. And so hopefully with spring actually almost here, that people are going to start to get out more and exercise more and eat less. And that this is going to be hopefully a new beginning, yet another new beginning, you know, for all of us. You know, and I wonder, you know, what have we, lessons to be learned? You know, what have we learned from the last year? I know that for me, I have learned that, you know, once things open up a lot more, that I really do need to connect in person, not just online with friends and with people who I actually care about. So hopefully there have been some positive lessons that have come out of you know, of all of this in the last year, and that we're going to be able to move forward and figure out, each of us, what our new normal is actually going to be. Well, I have invited my husband again, Jim Fredos, who is a sociologist, who is a former professor at Yeshiva University here in New York City, and John Jay College, and he is also the host of a really wonderful, wonderful television show on MNN called The Radical Imagination. And I think it's really important from time to time to get a male perspective on a lot of issues that typically women talk about. And yet the male perspective happens to be really important, especially a perspective from somebody who is a sociologist, who is an intellectual, who is an activist, who doesn't just run his life on emotions and feelings. So, Jim, thank you again for being here and joining me.
Thank you again, Bibi, for inviting me. I don't know how typical I am, but I am what I am, and will always enjoy doing the show with you.
Absolutely. Well, I want to start with an article that we began to talk about last week. And that article was in the New York Times, and the headline was, "You Were Duped Into Saying Yes. Is That Still Consent?" And I actually made an error when I was talking about this article, but this is the issue. This was the story. Right. Imagine the following medical situation, everybody. Frank and Ellen meet at a night course and end up getting drinks together after class several times. Sure. I had actually mistakenly said that it was just one time, and I think I came down very, very hard on Ellen, which was not fair. So Ellen and the Ellens of the world, I apologize to you. So here we go. The drinks start to feel like dates. So Ellen asks Frank if he is married? Good question. You want to vet the person who you're with, especially if you're attracted and you think that maybe you're going to want to have sex. So she asks Frank if he is married, making it clear that adultery is a deal breaker for her. So she wanted that out there, that if you are married, this is not going to happen. So Frank is married, but he lies and says he is single. So the bed and the question, in fact, I sent Dr. Roseanne Summers, and she's an assistant professor of law at the University of Michigan. I was hoping that she was going to be able to come on the show and talk with us about this, but her schedule, particularly since the piece was in the New York Times, she said her schedule is crazy. So maybe another time. So what happens is the two go to bed, and the question is Frank guilty of rape? So I'm going to give you a chance to respond, and then I'm going to go through some of the issues that Dr. Summers raised in this piece. So is Frank guilty of rape?
Not in any sort of criminal sense. I think most legal observers will agree with that. Is he guilty of fraud, of lying? Absolutely. And the interesting question as to the number of times they dated or went out.
Several.
Now, would that sort of gets us to thinking that it's getting to be more serious, and she's thinking more seriously about having sex. And presumably we're not sure what's inside his head either about the relationship, but he's meeting with her several times. They've met several times. And perhaps he too is looking forward to having sex with her, or having a deeper relationship. I mean, another question to ask.
Let me just stop you. Sure. He hardly could be having or be thinking about having a deep relationship. Frank is married, Jim.
I got
so
that.
For him, right. It may be just a hookup or a one-night stand, but they met several times. And I think that the several times, whether it's three times or six times, isn't really the issue. She asked him, are you married? And if you are, adultery is a deal breaker for me.
I understand, but going back to, could there be a possibility of him not being very satisfied in his relationship and possibly entertaining a deeper relationship? No,
I don't.
Okay. All right, well, let's leave that there.
Let's say you do meet someone and they're having problems in their relationship. And as you're starting to get to know one another, you right. might say something like, I like you. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling attracted to you. I'm having problems in my marriage.
Exactly.
To at least to put it out there honestly.
I agree.
And then she, Ellen, could have made the decision to either go to bed.
Do we know that, if he may have said that?
I'm sure that he didn't. So this is what Dr. Summers says. This question apparently has been a source of contention among legal experts for decades, ever since the law professor, and we know about her, Susan Estrich, argued that the law of rape should prohibit fraud to procure sex, just as the law of theft prohibits fraud to secure money. So here we have a situation, and I'm going to ask you this. Mm-hmm. Okay, you go to see a doctor, and the doctor performs a surgery after obtaining consent by lying. Does he deserve less punishment for medical battery than a doctor who simply performs the surgery without asking permission?
For the patient. In other words, the doctor
right.
did not ask permission for the patient?
The doctor performed a surgery
yeah.
after obtaining consent
right.
by lying. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So here we have a situation.
I would suggest medical malpractice.
Well, it certainly is medical malpractice.
Right.
But the fact is that in the face of the standard scholarly understanding of consent, which is that it is an expression of an individual's autonomous will controlling one's life as one would like. So she consented. Ellen consented to having sex with Frank, who she assumed, because he told her, was not married.
Well, I mean,
she did not. Let me just say, she did not consent to have sex with a married man. So that the sex, and so the argument goes, maybe not the legal argument, Jim, is that she had sex. The sex that she had with Frank was not consensual.
I can't see where it's legal. I think it may be immoral. It could maybe, you know, be wrong. But I don't see where in any way it's illegal in a criminal sense.
That's true.
So the degree to which...
But that's
lying
the question.
Occurs. Yeah, that's always the question. What social context? I mean,
right.
We've had, I mean, every single president we've had since I've been alive has lied numerous times to the American people. The Tet offense in Vietnam. We were lied to by Bush with the Desert Storm. It goes on and on. Now, is that criminal behavior? Is that enticing people into a war that should never happen? Of course, it depends on your viewpoint on that. Is it lying when, as a military or political leader, you send in your troops, your people under false pretenses? Absolutely. In this case, in this specific case, it was a horrible experience and shouldn't have happened. He should have been much more forthcoming. He wasn't. And that's that. That's so all I would say. As you would say over and over again, lessons to be learned.
Well, this is right? The whole thing, you know, in the dating scene now.
Right.
Yes, right. Lessons to be learned. You know, and I was making notes, you know, doing our homework, being cautious. But as you're getting to know someone and you ask them a straight question, mm-hmm. Are you married?
Mm-hmm.
And the person says yes. I mean, are we at a point in our lives where we need to have signed affidavits? A, I'm not married. B, I do not have a sexually transmitted disease. I mean, are we at that point? And is this situation unique? And I really wonder, I mean, I wonder how many people who are listening right now have been in situations where, you know, they ask a question. Are you married? Are you attached? Are you in a relationship with someone? And you find that the person lies. I mean, is this where we're at?
Perhaps for some people, and perhaps for people who are going out there and put it up front. This is what I expect. This is
she did. She said it.
Right.
She
in as it. You say in writing, I guess. I don't know if that would make much difference in writing or anything. I mean, we do. I wouldn't use the word. You know, we try to put ourselves in a position where the other person might like us, and sometimes we may enhance on our own lives. We may say certain things about ourselves
and
you know, embellish the truth. And I don't know if we're going to keep tabs on the amount of times that people do that, then I don't think we're going to get very far at all in relationships.
Well, there were a lot of people who responded
yeah,
in the New York
what'd
Times. And one person says, sorry, but this slope is way too slippery. Who among us has never said anything deceptive to improve the chance of sexual contact with someone we've just met? True, but not a very ethical argument. And another person, it's interesting, the men here, their letters were printed.
not everything that's wrong is a crime, nor should it be. If you want to sleep only with people you can trust, don't offer don't know. So, I mean, again, she's blaming Ellen, which is not something that we want to do. But this was a very interesting response also from a man, and this is what he says. Just to make certain that I understand this concept, if a woman lies to a man about her marital status and they have sex together, do these same feminist legal scholars believe that the woman is guilty of rape?
What do you think?
Obviously not. I mean, both were guilty of deception.
Would be. I think so. Absolutely. Let's be fair about it.
And of procuring sex in a fraudulent way.
But hasn't that occurred throughout history? I mean, men traditionally have wanted to achieve power and money and in the hopes of gaining sexual favors and marrying right and so on and so on. And women often have been left to their own sexuality, their sexual guile, if you will.
Well, I think things are changing. I think
that's
that
right.
There is this myth that somehow that women are less interested in sex and less sexual, and that it's men that are ones that are wanting to have all of the sex. And the fact is that simply is not true. Mm-hmm. And what we're talking about, I guess, is being careful and cautious. And these days in particular, you know, I thought that Ellen had just, you know, met him on one occasion, how we really do need to, yes, use my formula and teach people how to, you know, better assess who someone is and yet who someone is not. And yet there was a very interesting piece that I also wanted to get your feedback about what's going on online. There's a lot of scamming. In fact, according to the latest, and I was really surprised, this is a piece that was written by a friend of mine, Diana Kirshner, PhD, author of Finding True Love. And she was saying that according to the latest FBI figures, singles, mostly women, lost more than $362 million through online romance scams, through lying and deception. And she's seen this firsthand, where women are being asked to send money to their matches, and the requests were worded the same and came in on the same day. One of the women was seriously considering sending the scammer her money. She's lonely. She wants a relationship. Scammers oftentimes claim, remember, this is online dating, that they're doctors working abroad. They're in the military in an overseas location. They're working in the oil service. They're consultants. They live or they work outside of the country. And as the conversations are moving forward, they start to ask for money. They want your financial information. They're asking for money to so that they can be closer to you and live in your city. So again, we have to just be so, so careful who we let in our lives.
Well, I think the question goes a little deeper and more, and it's more involved with the nature of intimacy and love, and integrity, and
yes, it does,
and standing up for what one believes, or even have a vision of what one believes, and being able to express it. So this is something I think our society, our culture doesn't do very well in educating young people and older people about. So we careen from one scandal to another and scam and we become almost oblivious to it, numb It's to be expected.
Right.
And again, you know, be a Pharaoh, Woody Allen. Now it's finished the fourth episode, and the country is debating and dialoguing about that and so on until the next one. And it seemed like it's a very immature culture. And we should be surprised that it's producing many individuals that are lacking in integrity and lacking in capacity to be intimate and are seeking ways to, as you say, scam and lie.
But when we're lonely, you see, this is the whole thing. When you're lonely, mm-hmm. and you're wanting connection, and of course, you know, going back to my formula, and you're not really clear on the ingredients that go into a healthy relationship, and you're not really willing to take the time. And it doesn't happen in a week or 2 weeks. I mean, people have heard me talk about this all the time, that it really takes about a year to find out who somebody is and isn't. And you don't want to wait a year. You want that intimacy. You want that sex. You want that relationship. You want it because you just, like all of us, we want a connection. And yet, playing out the points of a match slowly, it's really important in order to protect ourselves. I mean, in the case of Ellen and Frank, I'm not sure what else she could have done. She asked him. He lied.
I agree with everything you've said. I would just add again that we live in a culture that seems to specialize in going after and taking advantage of the vulnerable. And that's true. You're talking about the lonely, whether it's in nursing homes, whether it's the poor and so on and so on. So this should surprise us. And so I agree with everything you're saying. And I think individuals and cultures have to devolve and develop into more mature ways of relating to each other.
Where integrity is prized. Sure. Where it really is important, because it is so true. We tend to embellish. We want people to like us. We want people to think that we are more than we really are. And yet, I mean, I hope that maybe, you know, just in looking at this example, that people may slow down the process of getting to know one another. And hopefully will then put themselves at less risk. Although, again, I don't know anything else that Ellen could have done in this particular situation other than ask the question after they had been, together after class for several times.
Well, absolutely. I think it would be very interesting. I wish we could have this hypothetical or, you know, person, the fellow on your show and see what he has to say.
Well, he wanted to have sex.
Well, let's hear what he had said. Why did he have lie. To? Why did he lie? That would to
because
me.
Because she said it was a deal breaker. She wouldn't have sex with him.
From him, I would be interested in his explanation as to why he thinks he needed to do that.
Because she was very clear. She said that she would not have sex with somebody who was married, and he wanted sex. So did she.
Yeah. So the question becomes: why did he take advantage of that situation? Yes. That's what I would ask him, and I think he needs to be told that's just not the way one should go about treating people. What is it about you that you have to resort to that?
Right. Well, I think we're not going to be able to have talk to Frank.
Frank, if you're out there, or Ellen, yeah.
Right.
But there are many Franks and Ellens out there, so maybe they would. Give you a call.
Yeah,
that would be wonderful to talk with you.
Yes, and I'm sure that there are people who are listening to the show right now who have been in a very, you know, a very similar kind of a situation. And be interesting to hear what they have to say. Well, let's move along. And I know that you and I, we've talked about this a lot. So the issue now, we're moving away from Frank and Ellen. We're now talking about should Governor Cuomo resign? And let me just bring our listeners and you also up to speed. So last week, when we were talking about this, there were three women who had come forward.
two who had worked with him and for him, and one woman who he met at a wedding, and he had sort of touched her back and she was really uncomfortable, and he hit her, and you know, she felt that that behavior was completely inappropriate. But this week, Jim, are you aware that seven women now, so we went from three to seven women have come forward and have alleged some form of sexual harassment or inappropriate touching. And again, I just want to bring everybody up to speed right now about what's happened, and then we can talk about this. So we have Attorney General Letitia James. She has launched an independent investigation into the sexual harassment and assault claims against Governor Cuomo. She announced the appointment of former acting U.S. attorney, a June Kim, and an employment discrimination attorney, an Anne L. Clark, as the two attorneys who will lead an independent investigation into allegations of sexual harassment levied against the governor. And accuser Charlotte Bennett, she was a former aide to Governor Cuomo. Interestingly and wisely, she hired Christine Blasley's Ford lawyer, Deborah Katz. And we know who Christine Blasley Ford is. I mean, she's a person who alleged sexual abuse against the Supreme Kavanaugh, against Judge Judge Kavanaugh. So Deborah S. Katz as representation now as the investigation begins into her claim that Cuomo made sexual remarks toward her. And Deborah Katz is best known for representing alleged sexual assault and harassment victims. And Governor Cuomo went ahead and hired Elkan Abramovich, who's a prominent New York City white-collar defense attorney. So here we have the situation. Each woman's story about her own experience with the governor, it's been consistent right from the beginning. Yeah. But why, and I want to hear your perspective as a sociologist and a man, why do you think that we continue to not believe women who allege sexual misconduct or assault, believing, just like with the Allen versus Farrow movie docuseries that we'll talk about, believing that they have an ulterior motive? Why not accept these women's allegations at face value?
I think they are being accepted. The Allen Farrow thing was 30 years ago with different social political contexts. I think they are being recognized, and that they're being promptly addressed, and there's commissions, and as you say, investigations.
Seven women. We'll see how many more come forward.
Right. And I would just add, since the modern era in politics, I mean, if you look at our presidents, and let's go back to Roosevelt, FDR, right. I mean, most of them, many of them, have had affairs either in office or, you know, in their political careers. I mean, we know that. It's well documented.
Well, Kennedy, they had affairs. If you're talking about affairs, well, then we're talking about consensual affairs.
Well, hopefully. Yes. Yeah. Hopefully. Well, certainly, perhaps, you know, with Bill Clinton, however you describe that is.
It was consensual with Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah, but still, again, the issue of power and power arrangements. With the point I guess I'm getting at is, I mean, this sort of shenanigans with politics has been going on for a long, long time. Sexual, relations and so on. I think though that I think that the times have changed, and the Me Too movement has, in fact, had an impact. And I think we are believing the women. I would just say, as a man, I have no problem with any of these investigations, and the speedier the better, and objective as possible. I just think we've got to really be careful we don't go the other way, and everybody should have a right to have some sort of due process in all of this.
And to be respected. And I think that what's happened, you're right, with the Me Too movement and things really have changed, is that women are now being given permission that we no longer need to be willing to be victimized.
And wouldn't you like to also see these women speak out for themselves at that time?
Yes.
I know it takes guts and courage and the power arrangements or such, but just simply say, hey, listen.
Cut it out. Right.
You know, or, you know, slap on the back or just, you know, or do whatever you have to do and make yourself heard too. I hope that many feminists would agree that that should happen also from women themselves.
Ideally. And of course, in certain situations, maybe not in this particular situation with these seven women, but women are concerned about their jobs, their livelihood. And you talk about the differential of power.
That's right.
And you have women, some women who are, you know, have a minimum wage kind of an arrangement. And there's fears about the repercussions. And I think, you know, I think it's one thing to be saying, oh, well, the women, and it's true that we need to speak up. We need to be educated. We need to give ourselves permission to be able to set boundaries and limits and say no and cut it out. But the point is, you see, again, that's saying, look, women, you know, you need to get your act together. But I think something else to consider is that men really now more than ever, and I think that they're having to re-examine their own behavior, like Frank, who lied to Ellen, and possible consequences of crossing over a certain line. Do you not agree?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would go further. I think this goes, I know we're talking about sexual, indiscretions as well at the workplace here, but I think we need to talk about this transcending identity politics. I think that a whole lot of people, men and women, are in very vulnerable positions at work and are used and exploited and dealt with in very, very harsh ways in that work environment. So it transcends what we're talking here about, which is important, absolutely. But I think it is about exploiting people and taking advantage of vulnerable.
Well, you know what really comes to mind right now, and you're probably going to be surprised that I'm going to mention this example, but look at what happened with our friend Cornel West. Look at what happened.
Yeah.
He did not get his tenure at Harvard. It had nothing to do with identity politics. It had to do with some of his political beliefs, where he was being, in quotes, I think, punished for not maintaining the status quo in certain areas, particularly, you know, vis-a-vis his feelings about Israel and the Palestinian people.
Well, yeah, you're opening up another large issue here.
But he stood up and he said, you know,
yeah,
what?
Yeah, speaking truth to power.
I'm not gonna stay, despite the fact you're gonna give me a chair and you're gonna give me some extra money.
Well, he used the word being disrespected.
He was disrespected.
And I think adding in his political viewpoints that upset the established authorities at the Harvard and so on. That happens all the time in a university setting. He's a high profile example.
He
of
was
it.
Able to do it because but I think he is a high profile person. That's right.
It's agreed. I think we're talking about similar sorts of things here.
Courage.
And integrity and standing up.
To stand up.
And take the consequences. And what we're adding here is this issue of sexuality, you know, the sexual indiscretions to the conversation, the examples you're giving, and of course with Pharaoh and Alan as well. So I think fundamentally you're right. These are the issues of exploiting or disrespecting or taking advantage cuts across the board here and becomes a particular issue. Adding the dimension of sexuality.
Right. And I think a lot of people, and I don't know whether or not it's just men, you know, will start to wonder and rate, whether or not what Governor Cuomo did really was such a terrible thing. You know, people talk about sexual harassment or inappropriate touching, and then they'll say, well, on the continuum, you know, it wasn't rape. He didn't physically force one of these women to have sex. And I think that that's one of the problems, that we should not be rating on a continuum sexual abuse, assault, or harassment, because a little bit of poison is poison.
When you say rape, just explain that a little.
Well, somebody might say, well, you know, he didn't rape her. He just may have made comments that made her feel uncomfortable, or he may have touched her back when they were at a wedding. And this was one of the women who had met him at a wedding reception. Not such a bad thing. Not so terrible. And my position is...
Are you saying it's a moral equivalent, or what are you saying?
I'm saying that we shouldn't be rating. If something makes Joan Doe feel uncomfortable, and Susie Smith is comfortable with a similar kind of behavior, I don't think it's fair to compare. Then the first woman needs to, as you've said, to find a way to be able to stand up and say, cut it out and stop it, and I'm uncomfortable. So, you know, because he didn't rape them doesn't mean that his comments or harassment were not things that were deeply, deeply disturbing to the women.
To the woman involved. And are you saying for some women it wouldn't have been?
Right.
Okay. Yeah,
right.
I agree.
Right.
I agree. The wide variation of what people are used to or are willing to tolerate
and are comfortable with.
Comfortable with and willing to, you know, give back to, in a sense.
And this is where it's true that we have to, as women and also men, we have to find a way to maybe not take back our power, but feel the power to be able to let people know, whether it's husbands or wives or bosses or friends, what the boundary lines really are. And when things don't feel okay, whether it's in interactions, whether or not it's behavior, that we're able to speak up. And it's hard to do, Jim.
Well, when you're talking about issues of power and control, you're also talking about fear of giving up that power and control. So whether it's putting people away in prison, whether it's trying to exploit them in the workplace, whether take advantage of them sexually in the political offices and so on, I think that's the larger issue. The fears that people have about intimacy, about a more egalitarian society, about a society that doesn't speak of empire and control of others, and so on, imperialism and so on. So I think that gets us into some very, very deep-rooted issues, culturally and individually. And so this authoritarian need to control is something that we need to really get hold of as a species. Otherwise, we're going to destroy each other. And so I agree, power is necessary, but we also need to know and understand why we use and abuse power. And
I wonder what Governor Cuomo would actually say about that.
It'd be great.
I mean, he probably in his position, he has said he feels he didn't do anything wrong. He apologized in his way if he unintentionally, you know, made the women feel uncomfortable. But I wonder whether or not, in some sense, as governor and as a male with a lot of power, that he may have felt entitled
I think you're right.
to do exactly what he wanted to do.
I think you're right. And I think he lost a lot of his integrity and decency that his father exhibited when his father was was governor.
Well, people have said that working in that environment has been a terrible experience, yeah. You know, over and above these seven women who've alleged, you know, sexual harassment. So we don't know about that. But, you know, you do, you get into a position where you feel that you can do anything that you want to do. And I think it's taken a lot of courage for these women to stand up. And the first woman, Ms. Bennett, I mean, after the encounter that she had initially with him when he was, you know, talking about, you know, his personal life and asking her a lot of personal questions, she did go to the supervisor. Mm-hmm. And we don't know exactly what happened, but we do know that she was moved to another job in another part of the building. And yet what's happened since then is that these women decided that they wanted to take it further and that they needed to take it further for their own sense of self-esteem.
Well, do we know how far they are going to go with this in terms of the investigation? Are they all on board with this?
Yes.
All seven are going to be part of this investigation.
Yes.
They're going to make statements and they're going to put this down in writing and
yes,
whatever happens.
And, okay. And one woman, as we know, hired this very, very
one
high-powered attorney, Deborah Katz.
I would just say, if I could, just one little fast thing about, you were talking about men needing to change. I think, again, I would, if Governor Cuomo was here, I would shame him in this way. I would tell him, go back and try to have a conversation with your father. And because you are acting in a way that is absolutely not what your father was about as a politician, as a man.
Mm-hmm,
And he needs to figure that out.
Well, behind closed doors, right. who knows how Governor Cuomo is feeling and how he is going to be behaving moving forward. You know, I just got a chat from my producer. Do you realize that the show is basically over? We have a minute and a half left. We were planning on talking about the Allen versus Pharaoh series, which ended. I think that we should probably do some commentary about that next week. I think it's really important. You know, we've had a lot of discussion about all of this. So everybody, you know, I really hope you've enjoyed this discussion with my husband, Professor Bedos, and myself. And then it gives us all some things to ponder about. And I hope that you are living your life in a way. And of course, I remind you every single week to do what's in your best interest. And of course, I leave you with my two weekly messages. And the first is to do everything that you can possibly do to love yourself. And of course, the second message is that we all, and certainly Jim, what you were saying is that we all need to do a much better job in finding ways to love each other. And I want to thank you so much, as usual.
Thank you, as usual.
For weighing in.
And love you, Bea.
Yes.
Thank you.
Love you, too. And let's end the show with my favorite song, and that is What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love. And have a good rest of the day. We'll talk with you next week, and be good to yourselves. And let's find ways, better ways, to love each other. Bye-bye, everybody.